Early Childhood Finance Committee to order. And we need to start the tape. So wait just a minute here. Oh, it started. Okay, good. Thank you. Well, welcome, members. Today we have a very interesting meeting. We have three of our best and my favorite presenters with us. We have Art Rolnick from the Federal Reserve Board, and we have Arthur Reynolds from the University of Minnesota, and Richard Chase from Wilder. Today is kind of so-called sort of Research 101, except the advanced version in terms of the economy, the university, and through research, documenting how the investments in early childhood really play out. So I think it's really good for us to remember that when you look at the research and when you look at the numbers, this is what you see. This is truly one of the best investments. I see we have a quorum. Representative Rosenthal, would you like to approve the minutes?
So moved.
Representative Rosenthal moves approval of the minutes for January 22nd. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay. The motion prevails and the minutes for January 22nd are approved. With that, members, we know that the governor's budget came out today. We are in the process of deciphering it as you are. We will have our budget hearing a week from today because we already have Louise Stoney coming in town for this Thursday. It looks like, and I can't get into a lot of detail, as you know, the details kind of come out further and further, but from the MDE side, it looks like there are no cuts, which we appreciate, and on the DHS side, there are some cuts to child care, 3% cut in the market rate and a 3% cut in the parent copays, a 3% increase in parent copays. Beyond that, it gets kind of complicated, but we'll be going through it more on Tuesday and have plenty of time to talk about, obviously, how that's going to affect our committee work and how we see that cut playing out. So more for that on Tuesday. With that, we will proceed. Dr. Rolnick, we appreciate you being here today.
My pleasure, Madam Chair.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
If you'd like to proceed and with your presentation.
Sure. My name is Art Rolnick. I'm the Director of Research at the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis. Among many of my duties there is I'm an Associate Economist with the Federal Open Market Committee. That's the major policy-making body of the Federal Reserve. We're meeting, as I speak here right now, in Washington. I'm glad you didn't invite me to talk about the economy. This too will pass, is what I tell people. And on this particular issue, I don't want you to think about it just as a short-run investment. This is really a long-run investment. I understand the budget problems the state has, but I think it's important to understand long-term where your best investments are. And as some of you know, the research that I've looked at over the last 6-7 years has convinced me that by far the best investment we can make today in terms of economic development is investing in high-quality early childhood education for at-risk children. I'll present that research. I will first go over some of the major results that I have found over the years and who has influenced my thinking on this, and then talk about how we took this economic lens to this research and why we come to the conclusion that this is an extraordinary return, if done with high quality, to investing in early childhood education for at-risk children. I should say that I also serve as co-director for with Arthur Reynolds, Human Capital Research Collaborative, which focuses on promoting early childhood research. That's a collaborative with Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis and the University of Minnesota. Again, this idea that we're in this for the long run and we're going to continue doing research in this area, we think it's very critical. I also serve on the board of Ready for K. That's an advocacy group for early childhood education. I serve on the MELF board that they created a few years back, the Minnesota Early Learning Foundation. It consists of some of the top business people in the state, including now the CEO of General Mills, the CEO of Best Buy, Cargill, Blue Cross Blue Shield, Charlie Weaver, Business Partnership, President Brunick is on this committee. Mike Cerisi is on this committee. Mike Fitterman. It's a very distinguished group, and as many of you may know, its main mission is to look at this research and to come up with the most cost-effective way of promoting early childhood education. I'll be happy to talk about our flagship pilot, which is a scholarship mentor program that is in place right now, mostly privately funded, although also including allowances that the state has for early childhood education. And besides MELF, I serve on the board of Twin Cities United Way and co-chair Success by Six. I'm on the National Scientific Council on the Developing Child, a national organization put together by Jack Shunkoff from Harvard, and that research there that I've been exposed to is on brain development, and I'll talk about that. I also have served on the Minnesota Council of Economic Advisors. I hate to say it, but since 1985, with Tom Simpson, difficult time projecting our outlook, but that's another one of my roles I play, and I served on the Star Tribune Board of Economics. So let me turn to the research. Bottom line, we found, again, with this economic lens, that there's a very high rate of return on investing in early childhood education. There's two lines of research that led us to that conclusion. The first is brain development research. Neuroscientists over the last 10, 15 years have looked at the brain development during the earliest years, and we'll talk prenatal to three. And what they show pretty forcefully, very poignant, that if a child's in a stressful environment and stress, poverty is a pretty good proxy for stress, that the brain doesn't develop properly. My mentor on that, I've already mentioned Jack Shunkoff. What Jack likes to say is the debate between nature and nurture is over. We know the environment matters. And what they can show with imaging, that if a child's in a very stressful environment, kind of the brain doesn't connect right. And in very extreme cases, the brain's actually too small. And they've convinced me that in the most at-risk case, you can't start early enough. In fact, age 3 may be too late. It's not that the brain doesn't have plasticity and can't adjust years later, but it's very expensive, very difficult to do. And from that literature, it's pretty clear, from an economic point of view, it's much more efficient to start early. There are actually some interventions, some programs that have attempted to work with children and parents at this early age. The research is very impressive. They show very high results long-term in terms of child development if they have a public health nurse working with the parents prenatal to three, that long-term you'll find that the children do significantly better. They actually had a control group, randomized control group, so they actually compared children that had the intervention to those that didn't. They followed them for 15, 20 years, and they found significant improvements with the children that were that had this kind of a program starting prenatal. More recent research shows with that kind of intervention, you can reduce the number of low birth weight babies, you can reduce infant mortality. We're just starting to get at the healthcare benefits, the long-term healthcare benefits of this kind of program. CDC out of Atlanta is taking a strong interest in this because they're finding that healthcare costs can be reduced dramatically. We actually haven't captured all those benefits, but in this one study, when we looked at the home visiting nurse program, we found the benefit-cost ratio as high as 5-1. So that's one line of research that I find convincing, that early childhood education has a high return. And these returns, most of them tend to be public in the sense that they benefit all of us, because our schools work better for all children, because there's less crime. I'll get into that in this next line of research. These are interventions, and you'll hear more from Arthur Reynolds on one of the most studied program and one of the more successful programs. The study that Rob Grunwald and I looked at, and this is, goes back about 6 years when we first started to ask questions about what was the outcome when you intervene. This is a Perry preschool study. It began in Ypsilanti, Michigan in the early 60s. They started a program with 123 at-risk families. They randomly divided them up into two groups. This is the second time I mentioned randomly divided. I say that this kind of control group. That's the best methodology you can find. So when you can select children that way, and it's not so easy to do, to actually do studies like this, but randomly divide them up into two groups, that's the best methodology you're going to find. That's what they did in Ypsilanti, Michigan in the early 60s. They started 3- and 4-year-old kids, 2-year programs, working closely with the parents. So these are parent-focused programs. These are 4- or 5-days-a-week programs with home visits. And they found those children, compared to the control group that didn't get the program, did significantly better in the 20, 30, 40-year study. It was interesting, in the 10-year study, when they had 10 years of data, Perry Preschool was viewed as a failure because the IQ scores for these children that were in the program went up, but by the 3rd grade they leveled off and were not that much higher than the IQ scores of the kids who didn't have the program. And so it was actually viewed as a failure. But when they got the 20-year results, the 30-year results, and now we have 40-year results, we find the outcomes are significantly better. And what do we mean by that? So the children who had these programs compared to the control group, they were much, much less likely to need special ed. They were much less likely to not to be retained in the 1st grade. They were more likely to be literate by the 6th grade, stay in high school, graduate, get a job, pay taxes, and the crime rate went down 50%. Rob and I, looking at this data, we find benefit-cost ratios with the 40-year study that were as high as 16, 17 to 1. We have a problem, though, with the benefit-cost ratios. They're very high. The problem with benefit-cost ratios is, as policymakers, you know you have limited dollars, and the question is, well, what is the benefit-cost ratio for building another prison? What's the benefit-cost ratio of putting more dollars into K-12? What's the benefit-cost ratio of putting more dollars into higher education? We don't have studies like that. We don't have randomized control groups like that. So Rob and I took the data we had is, in today's dollars, Perry Preschool was about $10,000 to $11,000 per year. It was a 2-year program, so we knew the cost. We put dollar values on the benefits, which economists can do. You can put dollar values on reducing the need for special ed, reducing retention, the child staying in high school and getting a job rather than not getting a job, paying taxes, staying off welfare, and we can put dollar values on reduction in crime. When you do that, under certain conditions, you can back out a rate of return. That's not a benefit-cost ratio. A rate of return is an annual rate of return on the investment. We ask a very simple question that business people would ask. You're going to put $20,000 plus into this investment. What's the return on that investment? So you can back out these numbers. Nobody's quite done it this way before. And we found the annual rate of return, inflation adjusted, was 18%. That's inflation adjusted. That's what economists call a real rate of return. Most of that return was public. Some of it was private because we estimate about 4% per year is private because the child in this program is healthier and gets a better job growing up and earns more income. But most of it, anywhere from up to 14% annually, was the public return because it reduces the cost of public education. It reduces the cost of crime. It reduces the cost of welfare. And we think the way we approach these numbers, we actually took a very conservative approach. Why do I say that? We didn't have data on siblings in the family. We're pretty sure that if the child is doing better, working with the parents, that the other siblings are going to do better. We didn't have data at the time. We still don't have a complete data set at the time on the parents' income. It turns out the parents' income goes up significantly because as they become more engaged parents with these opportunities, their income goes up. We're just starting to get data on children of the children. That's not part of this extraordinary return. We don't have data on the productivity of teachers. I was my college days, I did some teaching in inner city Detroit, and I can tell you when I taught a 3rd grade class, when all the kids were ready to learn, I was a great teacher. When half the kids barely knew their name, I failed. We don't have data on productivity of children. Odds are, if we start lots all these kids ready to learn, we're going to increase productivity of teachers. So I'm going to argue the way we looked at that Perry Preschool, and there's academic debates about this study. We took a conservative approach And if you wonder about 18% return, I used to, when I first gave this talk, yeah, we can do better in the market. Well, I think we, you know, we can now wonder. Actually, long term, economy grows at about 3% inflation adjusted. That should be your benchmark. If, as a public institution, you can be 3%, probably with public investment. We can be 3%. A very, very conservative estimate, we can be 3%. So, we argue this is a great return. We argue it has short-term and long-term benefits. We're way underinvested in early childhood education, not just here in Minnesota, but nationwide. So that was our conclusion. That's why we concluded that we're underinvesting in early childhood education. Let me just conclude by saying this study is a bit of a surprise to me. Once I went to the literature, and this was about 6.5-7 years ago, I thought it was pretty obvious once you went to the literature, and I thought what we were saying was pretty obvious. I claim no expertise in doing this research. The people to follow this afternoon have a lot more expertise in actually doing the research. But the research has been out there for many years. And yet after we gave this, we're basically writing this paper, doing this study for Ready for K, and little did I know that Don Fraser and Al Cui and Todd Otis were going to send this out to the world. And my co-author and I have been to virtually every state in the country over the last 6.5 years. We're working with a dozen or so governors. Both McCain campaign and the Obama campaign cited this work. We are now, there are pilots and models based on this research in about a dozen cities that are going on right now. I think people kind of get it that we need to rethink the way we educate or don't educate our kids, and in particular early childhood education. So let me conclude with that, Madam Chair, and I'll be happy to answer.
Okay, thank you, members. We have three presenters. We're going to try to do 20 minutes of presentation and 10 minutes of questions for each one, so I'm hoping you have some questions for each of our presenters. And we've been having solid testimony, so we haven't been asking as many questions, but I hope you have some questions. Anything? Representative Downey.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Mr. Romick. I remember when your report first came out, I was on the Minneapolis Regional Chamber Board, and the buzz that went through the business community based on that kind of an analysis. So thank you a lot for your work. Question relative to the studies, were any of the studied groups in kind of large-scale implementation? Could you describe the differences in kind of effectiveness at various size centers or the scale of the program?
So, Perry was one of the smaller studies, 123 families, as I mentioned, and it's been criticized for the small sample size. Although statistically, when you have that small of a sample size, very difficult to get significantly different outcomes than we did. Dr. Reynolds will talk about the Chicago study, and that's a much larger sample. And he gets some very, very impressive results. In fact, there are four longitudinal studies. There's the Abbott-Sedarian study, which starts much earlier, at birth, actually, with the family. Then there's Chicago and the Perry. We found that the rate of return actually ranged anywhere from 7 to, we're now up to about 18-19%. So there is a range depending on the program and the size of the program. I do think, though, there is a challenge here in bringing it to scale. Our point of view is we know the research says we can get these kind of results. The studies of Head Start, which is one way to bring it to scale, are not getting these kind of results. They're getting okay, and then there's some absolutely terrific Head Start programs, but on average, the results aren't as dramatic as what we've seen in some of these studies. We argue, and the Minnesota Early Learning Foundation is one of the flagship programs, is one, you got to start earlier. Head Start starts late. Head Start wasn't designed as a development program. It was designed initially as an anti-poverty program. My reading of the research is it's critical to empower the parents and engage the parents. Engagement here, I think, is everything. This is what we're going to try to show in the St. Paul pilot, that you engage parents. And that makes a huge difference. It's not just the center-based program itself. And we think where you empower the parents rather than the program, you use a business model, a market-based approach, we can get these kind of results. That's one of the reasons we're doing a scholarship model in along these lines. So I think it's a fair question to say, can you bring it to scale? I think one of the reasons we've got the business community on board here is because they want to find out if we can, and they want to see if this model will work.
Representative Downey?
Thank you.
Representative Lane?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you. You mentioned, again, the importance of stress, especially, example, through poverty, affecting the brain development seriously long-term. And yes, although the brain is plastic, it is, you don't want to know, as I say, you don't want to know the cost or the time that it takes to redeem that once you've set it in place. I just want to point out something that I just learned in my new committee, Public Safety, last week, that 80% of the inmates in our prison here in Minnesota went through the child protection system. Child protection system means that as children, they were undergoing severe neglect or abuse to the extent that their parents were under consideration for the termination of their parental rights. This is very, very serious. 80% of the inmates in our prison went through the child protection system. This means they were under severe stress as children, probably before they were born, and that this is something that we are then dealing with in this costly end result in the prison system. And then I would just throw in that as we undergo this economic crisis, which is going to get worse before it gets better, we need to realize that we are at a crossroads as to how we approach civilized society. Are we going to take care of the things that we know build a future society in which everybody is together in together in this job, or are we going to cut people off from the services that they need to make sure that we are all rising boats?
Dr. Romer?
Madam Chair, I agree. I've been exposed to the same type of research and literature that you're citing. It's very discouraging when kids are in that situation, and you know what the long-term effects are. What I find encouraging is we have programs. We have the Minnesota Visiting Nurse Program that works with these parents, and the research shows if you start a parent first child prenatal, I mentioned some of these statistics, you reduce the number of additional births. The parent is very willing to let you in the door at that point. Engagement here is critical. You can have wonderful programs, and I know we have wonderful programs, but if you don't get the adverse parents into the program, you know, I don't know what to accomplish. So I think engagement is critical with that risk. And again, the one thing we're looking at very closely is how successful we are. And we're providing lots of incentives. I'm the economist, and I'm going to tell you, to have incentives for these parents to stay with the programs is critical. We're providing incentives in these programs to make sure, to encourage the parents to stay in the program, because one, they get the home visiting nurse, and there's a holistic approach to how we treat that and provide services. And when the child turns three, they get a two-year scholarship. We think those are the kind of incentives that have a chance to keep those parents in these programs and keep them engaged so they don't end up.
Members, any last questions? I will ask Dr. Rolnick, if you talked a little bit about your thinking on sort of the structure of what would work and the mentors and so forth. When in your original proposal, can you tell us about what you think is ideal if there was all the money in the world for state government? What would state government, what would be our, to make our best investment really have the greatest return on investment, what should we be doing?
Let me say something about the money situation, because again, we're in a recession. We've had 10 recessions since World War II. We come out of recession. My guess is we'll be out of this recession either by the end of the year or early next year. And so, again, I want you to try to think long-term on this issue. You might not have all the money you want right now. Having said that, President Obama has made it very clear that early childhood education is going to be a priority of his. When he announced his choice for Secretary of Education, Arne Duncan from Chicago, he announced that there would be a $10 billion fund for cities and states to bid on for innovative early childhood programs. And Minnesota is in the lead here. I think it's very impressive to have an organization like MELF, for example, to apply for that money. And if I had my wish list, I'd have a mentor scholarship for every at-risk parent in the state. That's the ultimate goal. I think to get there, in our proposal, we suggested that you aim to build an endowed fund. We estimated about $1.5 billion endowed fund would provide enough interest. We may have to recalculate that with interest rates so low right now, but would provide enough interest so that every at-risk family in perpetuity would have the type of programs we're talking about. Now, we're building on existing programs, but I like to say, you know, for people who look at me and say $1.5 billion endowment, well, that's the cost of a 2-sport stadium. So I think we should keep that in perspective. This is a much better return.
Representative Downey?
Just like a follow-up, we had a discussion in our committee, I think last meeting, about the merits of the direction of this towards parents and scholarships and some of the administrative challenges. But your sense is that that actually is perhaps the critical success factor, and in spite of the challenges of making that connection and kind of going through the parents in a scholarship model, that you would strongly support that as compared to the kind of institutional model.
Yeah, that's my, Madam Chair, that's my reading of the research. There's lots of debate. I can tell you at our Ready for K board meetings, at the United Way board meetings, even at our, MELF, I think, buys the business model. I know there's some challenges. The system isn't set up right now to deal with the scholarship model as efficiently as it could, but, you know, that should be workable. We should be able to figure that out. There's very little overhead cost in the scholarship model. The power is with the parents, and the market responds. One thing I'm very proud of, because my critics were telling me in Frogtown, you're just not going to have enough high-quality early spots. I said, no, there's going to be a market response. Chad Dunkley, CEO of New Horizons. They invested $1.5 million in a new facility in Frogtown, which just hasn't been there for years. They filled it up. Chad Dunkley told me they filled it up faster than any other program they've ever filled up before with New Horizons. They now have 87 children in that program. This is in Frogtown. So in my view, if you empower the parents, starting prenatal with a public home visiting nurse program, educator, and then you provide that scholarship, that is the most effective way to bring it to scale. Every dollar in scholarships ends up in high-quality programs. The programs have to produce. I think that model will deliver.
Well, Representative Downey will do your follow-up, and then Representative Bly, and then we'll need to move to our next testifier. Representative Downey?
Thank you. Then, you know, one of the challenges of institutional models for human services is that you tend to create an economic demand for the very circumstance you're trying to lift people out of. Do you see this parent-focused, scholarship-based model as a way to not perpetuate at-risk circumstances? I mean, is there a way to not have this be a perpetuating cycle of dependency on the scholarships over the long haul?
Dr. Romick?
We think we're going to have research on the children of the children to show that if you get parents engaged, and children ready for school starting at kindergarten, so they do graduate high school and have a chance to make it in this economy, yes. We think we'll have a chance ending that cycle. I put this program up against almost any other one I've seen. I think it's pretty clear in successful families, engaged parents are a critical component. Empowered families are a critical component. It's not that, you know, certain programs can't succeed. I know they can. But if you're talking bringing this to scale, I don't know how you'd bring it to scale. I don't think there's a better way of bringing it to scale.
Representative Bryan?
I'm not really sure exactly how to capture what my thoughts are, but I'll try. Some background, I've spent most of my teaching career, and I've been a teacher for 30 years, working with at-risk families and at-risk kids. And it bothers me a little bit when... I agree with you that engagement is the key, and relationships are the key. But some of the language that I hear in this conversation about working with our human capital, or talking about things in very business terms, bottom line terms, That's not my experience in working with families and engaging and empowering them. And one thing that bothers me a little bit about the allowances and the scholarships, maybe they can work. I'm not totally certain that I have a full grasp of what you're proposing, but at the same time, my sense is that there isn't a depth of understanding of the families unless you really make a stronger effort to engage them, and merely giving them a scholarship or an allowance to choose something isn't really the same as we think of with empowering these families and the struggles that they face. And so I'm curious just how you might respond to what I've said.
I think it's a good question for us, and I think it's one of the challenges Mel faces. Where I think we will succeed is not so much, I mean, the scholarships are part of it, but the mentors start with the family's prenatal stage. And we have research to show that the mentors working with the mom in particular can change the way the mom and the child interact. And the mentor goes, we customize the mentor's family's needs, and so they may go once a week, and they may go three times a week initially. But the idea is we start that language interaction in a positive way, instead of the child being neglected in particular, and neglect here may be one of the largest problems. And we can make a huge difference in that interaction, and when I talk about brain development or the lack of it, that interaction is critical. So we think we can be educating the parent as we move along and the importance of the interacting with that child, and then give a lot of positive reinforcement. You're right to ask us, you know, will we succeed? MELF has an outside evaluator, SRI, formerly known as Stanford Research Institute. They're going to evaluate this whole program. If you go on our website, you'll see their preliminary evaluation, interview some parents and some providers, etc. You'll get a sense of what we're up to. But they're coming at this very objectively, because our board wants to know, are we succeeding or not, to get at your question. Now, I admit it may take a lot of years to get a definitive answer, but I think this kind of engagement has a real chance of succeeding, and it's definitely worth trying, especially since we have some research. This is David Olds, and his research shows that these programs can do exactly what we're saying if we do high quality. And we're going after the most at-risk parents. We're going after the parents who neglect or have problems of their own, and we're going to try to change that environment. If you don't do that, you've got problems down the road. So that's what we're aiming to do. That's what the research says. Will we be successful? I think so, but, you know, in a few years I'll give you a better answer.
Good. Members, thank you, Dr. Rolnick. Are you coming to the summit tomorrow?
I sure am.
All right. Well, look forward to seeing you, and appreciate you taking the time to be here today with us as well. Next we'll have Dr. Arthur Reynolds. Members, there still are a lot of questions, you know, on the differences between allowances and the scholarships and how it's structured differently. And it's what's interesting for me is when we started talking about this was all theoretical, and now we actually have money doing this. So it is kind of a great experiment, and it will be interesting if we can bear it out to see what happens with that. Next we have Arthur Reynolds, who's a professor at the University of Minnesota. He came from the University of Chicago. He is the, I want to say chief author, I think it's the chief researcher on the Chicago Parent Child Centers, which is a very, very famous study following kids in low-income areas and how they're doing. I think you all know I teach at the university also, and he's been great with that and recommending good texts to teach from and talk to the class. So he's someone I look at that we can all learn from. Dr. Reynolds, welcome to the committee. If you'd like to proceed, state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you very much, Representative Swalick. I'm Arthur Reynolds, Professor of Child Development at the University of Minnesota, and do a lot of work in the field of research on early childhood programs and also on social policy. And what I want to give you today, hope everyone can hear me, is sort of a whirlwind tour, you know, some of the research and policy implications of the research on early childhood programs. What I want to do, you have some background materials I've provided, so I'm kind of go back and forth and kind of highlight some of the key charts and information, from this work.
And I think certainly we all know Gerard and mine and other people's work about sort of the economic return, but I think I wanted to kind of emphasize, you know, a few key points about the research on early childhood and also as it relates to Minnesota and where Minnesota is in the landscape of early childhood programs in terms of access in particular. And so let me just walk through a few things. First, in the field, if we think about, you know, we know these long-term lasting benefits of early childhood programs. You know, and we've known this for probably the last 25 years. I guess what we haven't known as much is certainly in the last 5 years, there's been an increase in kind of knowledge about the economic benefits, the return on investment, the long-term economic benefits of early childhood programs like Chicago or Perry Preschool or Epidary and the others, as Art Rolnick mentioned. But I think another way to frame this, too, is in terms of reducing gaps. And I think in a couple ways, high-quality preschool programs can eliminate the school readiness gap. And the second thing that high-quality early childhood programs can do, in addition to these long-run benefits, is it can reduce by up to 50% the third-grade achievement gap due to socioeconomic status. These would be gaps associated with the socioeconomic status gradient, the difference between performance between lower and higher FBS groups. And let's give an example of this. And we see these gaps in learning. Between those high levels of socioeconomic status, those at lower levels of economic status. And we can see in the Minnesota Department of Education readiness survey, they indicate that overall, kids in Minnesota, kindergartners, 13% of all kindergartners are not ready in language and literacy when they enter kindergarten. And that this varies, that parents that have less than a high school education, 31% of the children of those parents are not ready in language and literacy, compared to only about 6% for parents that have a college graduation degree. So that's about a five times, you know, higher rate, you know, for those that have less education versus those that have more education. And that early childhood programs, in addition to these long-term benefits, can actually reduce these gaps. And let's look at this in an example with a child parent center program that I have been working with, you know, for the last 25 years or so. And so let's look at CPC stands for Child Parent Center Program, and let's look at school readiness in terms of literacy composite. And if you look at this, those not in the program, those that do not have a high-quality preschool program, when they start kindergarten, they're at the 28th percentile on the language and literacy continuum. The national norm, of course, would be the 50th percentile. Now, kids that have 2 years of the Child Parent Center program not only have closed that gap, you know, from 28 to 50%, but actually have had higher performance than the national average. If they have 2 years of this half-day preschool program, these are high-risk kids, mostly all African-American, high-poverty neighborhood children, and being at the 57th percentile when they start kindergarten on this literacy composite. So it's a key. So if you take an average of the 1 and 2 year groups, and that's about 1,000 kids in the Child Parent Center program. And I might point out that this program has operated Chicago Public Schools for since 1967. It's funded by Title I, is run by the Chicago Public Schools, has been run by Chicago Public Schools in all these years, and is a school-based model that has served over 100,000 families since 1967, all with federal dollars from Title I, now no child left behind. So you can see a good example of early intervention reducing this gap. Now if we extend out and follow kids to third grade, we can see that the gap in terms of reading performance is lowered by about 50%. So if we continue this, so what is it about the CPC? Because clearly all early childhood programs, preschool programs, won't eliminate the gap. Most programs won't even reduce the gap in third grade reading scores or literacy by FCS, you know, certainly by third grade. So in the CPC model, I think it's a marriage between high quality kind of child educational enrichment and heavy emphasis on parent involvement. And you can see here, you know, the key staff besides the head teacher is, one, you have the teachers and aides in the classroom in a very small classroom setup, so that there's no more than 17 children in a preschool class, you know, with two adults, and that you have a heavy emphasis on parent involvement. And so each of these centers has a parent resource room, parent resource teacher that provides home visitation services, field trips, parent support groups, all kinds of family support activities to kind of bolster educational enrichment that's also being provided in the classrooms as well. So you have this wonderful integration, the synergy between direct services to classes, to children in classrooms, and also a heavy emphasis on parent involvement. And then there's also a continuation aspect of the program that I'll get to later. So we can see a live example here, a large-scale program that is run by public schools that can reduce these gaps and also has these long-term gains that I'll allude to later. And so let's take this now in relation to where kind of the state of Minnesota is, that these high-quality programs can have these investments. What does Minnesota do in terms of investments in preschool? And when you look at high enrollment states, and certainly, you know, the bottom line is it's a tremendously under-investing in early childhood education. Let's look at two sets of states based on 2006-2007 school year data from the National Institute of Early Education Research that publishes annually the preschool yearbook that documents levels of access and funding and quality of all state-funded preschool programs in the United States. And you can see here that for four-year-olds, now I'm emphasizing your four-year-olds in 2007, what percentage of four-year-olds in the entire state, regardless of level of risk, are enrolled in a state-funded preschool program? And you can see here, you know, some of the top states, Oklahoma, Florida, Georgia, have at least 50% of all four-year-olds in those states enrolled in state-financed, state-funded preschool program, typically classroom-based programs, meet every day, 5 days a week, at least 3 hours a day. And you see the average state spending per child in these states ranges, you know, the top three or four range from about $2,500 in Florida to over $4,000 in Georgia and about $3,000 in Oklahoma. And you can see Wisconsin is about ninth on this list. And the per child, so I guess the access would be the percentage, sort of the generally perceived quality would be the right side, would be the state spending. Now, if we look at the low enrollment states, we find that Minnesota, as a percentage of all four-year-olds enrolled in state-funded preschool programs, Minnesota is 37th out of 38 states that have state-financed pre-K programs in terms of 2% of all Minnesota four-year-olds are enrolled in a state-financed preschool program, and it's all because of the Minnesota matches the federal Head Start program with state dollars, and those are the kids in Head Start in Minnesota. And clearly you're at a disadvantage here if you don't have a state-funded preschool program, and Minnesota, besides Head Start, doesn't have one. And at least according to the quality criteria that I'm going to lay out. But again, what we spend per child, though, is actually fairly high in quality in terms of Head Start services. And you see, you know, some of the other states as well show a different level of access. So we see that as a percentage of students in state-funded programs, Minnesota is a very small percentage in these programs. Now, if you look at the kind of pre-K funding in Minnesota, and the idea here is we want these very high-quality programs, access to high-quality programs like the Child Parent Center program, like the Perry Preschool program. What does Minnesota fund? In terms of 2006 dollars, we find that the main vehicle, the mechanism for school readiness would be the Minnesota School Readiness Program, and that allocation is $9 million per child. I mean, $9 million total. We'd like to have $9 million per child so we could all put it in the bank.
It'd be first.
And the allocation here, and as you know now for this year, it's about $10 million. So the per child allocation is $283 expended per child for those in the Minnesota School Readiness Program. Of course, the Minnesota Head Start Program, you can see a difference there. It's much higher. And you compare that to what other states provide in terms of their school readiness programs, And, you know, the main reason why it's so low in Minnesota is there's no statutory regulations for what the programs have to provide. And I'll allude back to that in a couple of minutes. But you see, you know, our border states, Wisconsin provides over $80 million per year for preschool programs for four-year-olds. Illinois, almost $300 million. Georgia, over $300 million. It has large allocations per child. Now, if we look at the school readiness program, you know, the state or the NEAR has been criticized a little bit for providing numbers that doesn't count some kids that have state pre-K. Now, even if I adjust for the fact that Minnesota might be undercounted because NEAR does not include the school readiness kids in there, as it turns out in the parent survey that the Minnesota Department of Education provides, 2,500 parents indicate that they receive school readiness dollars that then go to contracted preschools or child care centers. Kids that would potentially be not counted in the NEAR numbers. So if you include, for example, the 2,500 kids that in these contracted preschools, the number would go up from 2% to 6%, which is still a rate that is about four times lower than the national average. So let's look at high-quality preschool, high-quality programs show long-term cost-effectiveness. And let's look at the CPC model. Let me just make a couple points about the long-term evidence. So in the Child Parent Center program, the sample is now 28. We follow two groups of kids, 1,000 children in this Title I-funded school, sustained, you know, upscaled early childhood intervention, 1,000 kids in the CPC program, 500 kids in the comparison group who got the usual treatment services or the usual program services, which would either be a full-day kindergarten or Head Start. And we followed their progress into adulthood through the school-age years. And a couple points here. One is you find the more common findings reduced rates of school remedial services, but you also find the uncommon finding are significantly lower rates of child maltreatment associated with participation in the CPC preschool program, about a 50% reduction in rates of child maltreatment, which is quite linked to the earlier question about just those incarcerated, the high percentage of those in the child welfare system. If programs can reduce the likelihood of child maltreatment and out-of-home placement, that they stand a chance of being very cost-effective.
You probably have Dr. Reynolds, yes. Probably about a little less than 10 minutes.
Okay, thank you. And then if we look at rates of incarceration, we find that by age 24, about a 20% lower rate of incarceration associated, reduction in incarceration associated with program participation. And if we translate these dollars into economic benefits per dollar spent, we find, based on our age 26 cost-benefit analysis, we find that every dollar invested in the Child Parent Center preschool program provides a return to society of $11 per dollar invested, $11.41. We find that that breaks down across the board into K-12 education, increased tax revenues because of higher educational attainment leading to better jobs, reduced crime, savings for health, which would be savings to child maltreatment and also to tobacco and substance use, and also increased earnings. So we see that across the board, not just through savings to K-12 education, which is among the lowest, but across the board, high rates of return associated with program participation. So what are the elements of these programs? If we were to upscale and to provide services to all Minnesota families, or certainly to those at risk, what would be the common elements of programs that show high economic returns? One is that there's an opportunity for more than 1 year of participation. This idea of dosage, and Art alluded to it in his talk as well, is very critical, providing more than 1 year. Having well-trained and compensated teachers, low class sizes, small class sizes and ratios less than 9-to-1 in terms of classroom support, instruction that's diverse and literacy rich, certainly comprehensive family services, the emphasis on parent involvement, and typically an average yearly cost per child of no less than $5,000. If we look at the programs that have these long-term effects, long-term economic returns, that give this high return on investment, they tend not to be the ones with the lowest denominator cost, that they're providing a lot of services at a relatively high cost compared to the typical program, but they provide more than enough benefits later to make up those costs. And if I look at just investments, if I organize all the evidence that we see out there in the field in terms of return on investment for different kinds of programs, what we see is that certainly early in the first year, in the first 5 years of life, we see return per dollar invested quite significant for prenatal programs like WIC, infant programs that have home visiting, and also preschool programs for 3 and 4 year olds. And then investments after preschool, they don't turn to zero. They don't turn to zero return, although on average, those returns of small class sizes, reading recovery, are going to be on average lower than the returns that we get for preschool. And for example, in the analysis of the effects of full-day kindergarten compared to half-day kindergarten, there were no enduring achievement gains associated with full-day kindergarten compared to half-day kindergarten in terms of student performance. And so that's why, you know, it's basically a wash as far as the long-term effect goes. But for preschool programs, the evidence suggests, of all the evidence we've looked at across the programs, is that there's the most consistent evidence is preschool programs for 3 and 4 year olds give the highest return on investment comparatively than other programs. But on the other hand, too, given the at-risk conditions of family space and communities, that we need programs that also have a synergy, have a continuum. And so the birth to five or birth to eight programs that first decade of life is very important, and we need to study programs that look across that whole span, starting at birth and going forward. The other piece of evidence, so, you know, some of the new evidence, these long-term cost-effectiveness findings, the other new evidence is that states have dramatically increased investments in pre-K programs. So what does that mean for Minnesota? One, it means that these programs can be effective. The upside is that all these states, New Mexico, Arkansas, New Jersey, Oklahoma, Tulsa, and others, have analyzed, have done research on the programs to show significant improvements in school readiness to the tune of 3 or 4 months of performance, about a third to a half a year increase in performance for these large-scale programs, you know, with thousands of children. Some serve more at risk, but generally they serve more of a mixed SES group. So that's good news for expanded investments in early childhood. And if I continue this notion of cost effectiveness occurring only for high quality programs, but let me just focus on, you know, these key elements of effectiveness. And so if Minnesota was to try to increase access or provide a system of early education for birth to five, certainly for preschool and pre-kindergarten, certainly the early timing is critical. The beginning early, no later than age 4, provide sufficient length, provide intensive research and services, comprehensive family services in terms of parent involvement, small classes, all that follow the, you know, the CPC and other kinds of models. Well-trained, compensated staff, certainly a primary focus on at-risk children, a compensatory focus, a focus on trying to, you know, to make up or to enrich literacy, for example, through literacy-based curricula, a strong accountability system, and transition services.
Dr. Reynolds, we're going to ask you to start to wrap up.
Yeah, okay. A couple minutes. And I think if we take this template and apply it to Minnesota investments, we find that the effectiveness across these principles, you know, really don't stand up to scrutiny, in that programs such as school readiness, for example, have no statutory requirements for most of these key principles of effectiveness. And just to give you a couple of examples, one, there's no statutory requirement for length of the program or the amount of time. In terms, it could be 1 day a week, it could be classroom-based, it could be out-of-classroom-based. No statutory requirements related to length, no statutory requirements on intensity, no statutory requirement on the services provided and comprehensive services, no statutory requirement on small classes, no statutory requirement on teacher training. and then no statutory requirements on transition services. So you can see, just based on the quick effectiveness of services against the key principles of effectiveness, that the school readiness program needs to be completely revamped. The last point I would make in terms of this rationale is that we need to provide school transition services. If we look at other models out there, and the CTC is certainly one of them, if we look at what successful states have done in terms of modeling and setting up a system of early education, there's three types of models out there. One is that financing systems is based on the school funding formula that Wisconsin does. And their four-year-old kindergarten program started, you know, back in the 1800s, believe it or not. They provide a reimbursement based on the school funding formula, all run through the public schools. A second model uses lottery proceeds in sort of a public-private venture in Georgia that is run by a separately funded, separately organized Department of Early Care and Learning in the state of Georgia. And that uses lottery proceeds and not school funding, not block grant revenue. That model has been a public-private venture in Georgia is another way, another model of financing. And a third way is sort of the model from Illinois, and it uses block grants from the state legislature to school districts or child care centers or Head Start centers to develop programs as they want to, meeting principles of effectiveness. And that all three of those models, I think, are quite effective and have been well implemented, you know, in the last 20 years or more. And are lessons, I think, for Minnesota as well. I see advantages to all those. But I would say that these are the three leading states that Minnesota can adapt and learn from as far as running and developing a system of early childhood education that maps onto the evidence that you find in the Child Parent Center program. So in conclusion, I would say, one, recommendations from this little tour is that, one, we need to increase access to high-quality early education programs as part of a coordinated system of services that don't exist in the state of Minnesota. Second, we need to create a strong school readiness program and not just a funding stream. Third, programs must be evaluated and assessed for their impact on learning. All current existing investments should be able to pass some basic cost-benefit test or at least some effectiveness test to continue at the level they exist now. So we invest in programs proven benefits. And we have to provide kind of smoothened transitions between preschool and kindergarten to help encourage these long-term effects. And the last thing is we need to adapt funding administrative structures and look for new models, too, from states that have proven successful in increasing both access while maintaining quality. And the three I mentioned, I think, are three of the leading examples. I'll stop there. Thank you.
Thank you. Members, do you have questions? I think for me, this is always challenging because you point out what our weaknesses are, and there certainly is a lot of improving we could do in Minnesota, and then it's interesting to see other models of kind of where we could go. Representative Peterson? Do you have a question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to follow up with one of your points about well-trained, compensated staff and what you think the training might be. Certainly we know that early childhood training at some higher ed institution is important, and it gives us the base for being able to conduct a classroom that runs efficiently and then it has all the components of a good program. But we were at a conference this summer that talked about the most important factor being the relationship of that teacher with the children. And so do you have in your mind what is an adequate program for early childhood teachers, or would it be a differentiated staff with a lead teacher with a bachelor's degree and then maybe a two-year degree and something else? Have you pursued that at all?
Thank you, Representative. I would say that certainly, you know, you want both. You want highly trained staff and you want, you know, strong teacher-child relationships. And I think, you know, the research is, I think it's fairly clear that you're more likely to have stronger and better interactions, more variety of activities with up to knowledge materials like on literacy if the staff are well trained and certified. So in my mind, if I go back, let's go back to just the returns and the long-term benefits of early childhood program. No economic benefit that had been found for program where the classroom teachers were not either certified teachers with bachelor's degrees or were paid on the public school salary scale. So I think, in my mind, this idea of well-certified teachers, that the goal should be that teachers in preschool programs should have a bachelor's degree and should be certified, to teach that area. Of course, the capacity to have that now in the state and other states to make that happen overnight, like next year, everyone going to have it, is probably not realistic as well. So we need to kind of, have a time frame where we would get to that as well. And so certainly I don't think the expectation of a first grade teacher, having a bachelor's degree, it shouldn't be a different expectation for preschool teachers or early childhood teachers. It should be high training and also strong compensation, because the other factor is that you can have high certification or high training without compensation, and then you have sort of the revolving door, a lot of transitions out and retraining staff and losing staff because of salaries. And so increasing kind of professionalization, the level of training, would help prevent that as well. And so I think the idea would be that would be the goal, to have highly trained, certified staff with a BA or certificate in early childhood education, but over the next 5 years or so have a plan to kind of move to that as the ultimate standard.
Members, we're going to need to move forward. Dr. Reynolds, thank you for coming in today. And members, one of the reasons we do this is so you have a resource, too, is Dr. Rolnick. You can follow up with him, with Dr. Reynolds, if you have questions. I thought one of the more interesting things is the all-day K statistic versus preschool, and sometime we might want to talk about that. We appreciate you coming in. Next, we will have Richard Chase from the Wilder Foundation. And he has done, Wilder's done a number of studies, if you're not familiar with them, on a number of child care issues. I think he's waiting for the PowerPoint. There we go. Well, I'll have to do an infomercial for the Early Childhood Summit in the meantime. I hope you're all coming tomorrow, because it's going to be great. We have, I think, about 75 members or more coming. We also have some of the public will be sitting on the floor. So those of you, I didn't get to announce this in session, if you're used to sitting in your seat, you probably won't be in your seat tomorrow. We're going to have members up towards the front. We're going to fill in with the public in the back. Governor Cui and so forth, they will be up in the very front. So don't be surprised when there's different seating when you come in the chamber tomorrow. I think it's going to be a great day. David Lawrence, who is coming in as a national speaker, is visiting with the Star Tribune and the Pioneer Press editorial boards and doing a number of TV shows and radio and all kinds of things. So there's high interest in the summit tomorrow, and in the speaker, as well as in Jim Houlihan, who will be doing the rural perspective. So hope to see you all there. You're Dr. Chase, right? Is it Dr.?
Yes, Representative Flowers.
Yes, I thought so. Are you coming in, sir?
I am.
All right. Well, we will see you tomorrow as well. Thank you for being here today. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you for inviting me.
If you'd like to state your name for the record. And
I'm Richard Gates. I'm a consulting scientist at Wilder Research, which is part of the Wilder Foundation in St. Paul. So you've heard from the ARC about the investing in quality early education for low-income, high-risk kids yields big returns. So the study that, one of the things I want to talk about with you today is sort of turn that equation on its head and around it. What are the costs of not investing? We know there's big returns if we do invest, but what is the cost if we don't invest? And we did this study for the Bush Foundation, and they were interested in the cost, focusing on K-12, just the K-12 system as a whole. So it's not the cost to individuals or to taxpayers or to society where the big returns are, but focusing specifically on the K-12 system. And we use the method from all those studies that Dr. Rolnick and Dr. Reynolds talked about, including the Dr. Reynolds study, to look at how they monetize the returns, and then we plugged in the data we have specifically for Minnesota from the Department of Education. Most of those studies focus primarily on the returns because of savings to reduce special education costs and then with fewer kids receiving grades. Those are the big returns, or the returns they look at in most of those studies. Recently there have been other studies, especially in those states that are looking at universal pre-K, where they've been looking at other things that show up in costs or returns to the school with regard to teacher satisfaction and safety and so on. So we use whatever method we could find. So this study was limited by what other methods had been tried in the past. We didn't create anything new because we didn't have the time or resources, and we were limited to what data were available from the state. So in some ways, I think it's a conservative estimate. So we had to figure out first what was spent or what was lost, and then we had to attribute how much of that can we say is due to kids being unprepared for kindergarten or because there's not enough investment, there's not enough adequate early care and education for those children. So it's two things, figuring out how much it costs or how much you could save, and then attributing a portion of that to the early education issue. So it doesn't show up on the screen. So it adds up to $113 million. About a third of that is the net loss of per people laid to the system. So kids start behind. There's a readiness gap. There's a gap by third grade. If you're failing in third grade, the likelihood that you could be dropping out early increases. So that dropout is part of the loss of state aid, and that's attributed to starting school unprepared. About 20% of that could be attributed to that. There's teacher-related costs. There's some special education and greater repetition costs. So the teacher-related costs and the loss of state aid are bigger than those special ed and grade reduction costs. There's also some issues around kids who've never had any preschool experience, and then starting school and having to catch them up both with education and with English, and that's part of the cost of the school system. And then there's school safety costs that can be attributed to early education. So the dollar amount is $42 million total net. So if you keep kids in school, it actually costs money to educate them. So you have to figure out how much aid you lose, and then you have to add back in how much if they stuck around, how much it would cost. But because these kids are spread around the whole state, it's not like you're adding a lot of classrooms or losing a lot of classrooms. So there's not that much, doesn't have a huge amount, but it adds up to the most largest proportion, which is $42 million net in per pupil age of the school system. The teacher cost, teachers staying home because they are sick or have an unsatisfactory working condition, or they quit their jobs and move to a different district where it might be the classrooms are better behaved. Or there's a higher compensation of 2 to 3% overall because you're paying them more for the conditions that are unsatisfactory to work in. Those teacher-related costs add up to $29 million a year. The special education costs. So we're looking at just those that are preventable special education problems. They're not the severe ones, but they're mild to moderate developmental issues, they're learning disabilities, there's some moderate, mild hearing loss, speech problems. Those are the things that we looked at to see if we could prevent those. And it turns out to be about a 12% reduction based upon, or the cost is increased by 12% if you don't have kids prepared early on. It adds up to over $24 million a year. About $11 million in costs for kids who are learning, are both having no early education but also learning English when they first come to school. And then about 19% of the overall spending for school safety can be attributed to early child education lacking, which adds up to about $6 million of that amount. So overall, $150 million that could be spent on better things than being either spending on this we wouldn't have to, or this, or the school system foregoing the amount because of loss of, because of dropout. So, We have this frame of early education, unprepared kids, so the solution we looked at was an early education solution. But I want to talk to you more today about some other ideas we could think about that aren't just banking on the high cost of early education for these at-risk 3- and 4-year-olds. Because you can see it's a huge amount if you want to serve them. So we looked at a little different data than what Arthur looked at. Using census data, we looked at how many low-income 3-year-olds, so it's 125% in poverty and below, are currently not enrolled in either a public or private nursery school or some sort of center-based CK program. It turns out there's roughly 13,000 kids that have fit that bill. So what would it cost to get them the early education they need in the type of evidence-based high-quality program that Arthur was talking about? So the average of these programs are expensive. Overall, it's just the average. It's between $13,000 and $14,000 a year. We took the middle of that, $13,500 a year for 2 years. It adds up for those 13,000 kids, 2 years, to $377 million. If those kids then work their way through the school system over 15 years, you'd end up with your cost savings. If you only get the school district, would only get back 30 cents on the dollars, they have to pay for that all $377 million. So if the school district are trying to prevent the costs that are that show up there, the burden they have, it's going to cost at least $377 million to prevent those $113 million. So clearly, it goes beyond the school system's capability of reducing the cost on their own. It's going to take a public-private sort of collective whole state responsibility to somehow reduce those costs where the burden shows up in the school district. So I've been part of this early childhood business planning process that some funders in the Greater Twin Cities United Way have commissioned. And I've been around the state talking with local communities and looking at existing information and looking at the assets that Minnesota has around early care and education. This information will be released in the next month or so. But and we have lots of different building blocks in place that we could build on in addition to building on this quality early care and education as one of the solutions. So one of those is think about how can we strengthen families and all caregivers of young children as opposed to focusing just on the early education of young children. One reason I think we have to think about that and why we have to think about approaches that get us out of the rut we're in, our business-as-usual rut. I think most states are in this business-as-usual rut. And to follow what other states have done, I think we might be following a rut that leads to who knows where it leads. We need to create a new rut for ourselves and show the way, I think, create a new way of doing business, transforming business as usual.
So that case, you're going to tell us about the new rut, right?
Yeah, I know.
Let's see if we can get a rut in the rut, in the new rut.
So one reason we have to do this is because our infants and toddlers and preschoolers, they're more diverse than any other age group in the state. And that diversity is growing. We have to come to grips with this. Minnesota is a multi-ethnic state. Also, so we know that, think about this, the study I NELF baseline study I did, 50% of the kids age 5 and younger in the Twin Cities urban core are an immigrant or refugee family. 50% of the young kids in urban core, immigrant and refugee families, in urban core, immigrant and refugee families. 55% of the preschoolers served by the Worthington school district preschoolers are Latino migrant immigrant families. 55, so not even urban, it's greater Minnesota. They don't have Spanish-speaking ECSE teachers and preschool teachers in abundance in Worthington. You know, they're punting. What do we do to serve these kids? We have to figure out how to do things in a different way. So context matters. And we have to think about how we can be tailored and be flexible with what our approach is, so it's not just one type of model, because the context varies in rural Minnesota, the context with the tribes, and all the different culture communities that we have now in Minnesota. We have to think about how we can be flexible in approaching this and not just come up with one solution. And our assets that we have in place also have to come to grips with this. We have our early learning standards. We have our kindergarten assessments. You heard about the scholarships and the allowances. We've got a beginning of a QRS with the parent aware system. We have the beginning of a professional development system for child care and early childhood educators. But none of these have come to grips with the multi-ethnic part of Minnesota or how they work in rural Minnesota. We really have to think how they work outside of the urban core. So let me briefly give you three things, ideas you can think about how we can be transforming what we do now, redesigning what we're doing now, delivering ways to get the results we expect, but in ways that are taken into account the whole family within these different cultural contexts. We talked earlier about kids in stress. 10 to 20% of kids right now, young kids, their mothers are suffering from maternal depression. That's a risk factor for poor cognitive development, social, emotional development. One way we can sort of identify this earlier and get these the mothers the help they need is that think about well child visits as well family visits. Taking a more holistic approach in how we families encounter the healthcare system or the early childhood screening system. Focus broader than the individual child in the context of their whole family. Second, the enrollment scholarship. If you actually talk to Art and push him in a corner, he'll tell you he never said they're going to work in rural Minnesota. He understands that they really do take this sort of dense population for them to work. That you've got to take an isolated, disadvantaged family in greater Minnesota where there's no resources. Even if they had a scholarship, where would they spend it? There's no child care center in Bemidji. No child care center in Bemidji. Think about that. So, one way to think about this is, in adapting a scholarship idea, is to think about not family scholarships, but community scholarships. Essentially, that's what they're doing in Grand Rapids, where they blended Head Start in school readiness money, Blandon Foundation, private money, has given that community a scholarship to now serve not just kids at Head Start eligibility, but income eligibility higher than Head Start. Families in Itasca County that are at poverty or just 25% of, or $200 above poverty have the same issues. So those kids aren't eligible for Head Start. Now they're getting the same sort of Head Start experiences as other kids through the community scholarship that is offered by the Blandon Foundation. I think you'll hear more about this tomorrow at the Invest Early program. And we've been following that now for 3 years. We have the results of the third year aren't out yet, but they're closing the readiness gap between the low-income at-risk kids and the higher-income kids in Itasca County after 2 years of this Invest Early investment. All right, so last. 35 years ago, I don't know how many were in this legislature 35 years ago, but we were the first nation, first legislature in the nation to fund early childhood family education, ECFE, an incredibly popular program. It faced stiff opposition 35 years ago. The first time it was offered, it wasn't passed. Then it was funded on a pilot basis, small grant basis. And then it took 10 years before it got state aid on a formula basis. So for the past 2 years, this legislature was the first in the nation to support family, friend, and neighbor care, giving grants to support those caregivers, understanding that where are the 0 to 2-year-olds in the state? They're either at home with their mother or they're in family, friend, and neighbor care primarily. That's where they are, especially in the cultural community. That's their first choice. It's not a, it may be their only option for some because they can't afford child care or anything else, but often it's the first choice because it transmits culture, someone they trust, and so on. But we have to recognize that this is an early learning opportunity for those kids with family, friend, and neighbor care. So, if we want to have a successful multi-ethnic state now and in the future, one way we could be a beacon for other states and take the next step is, let's say ECFE is no longer ECFE,
It's easy. FFNE. Rename it.
Did you come up with that?
Yeah.
Wow. I think we're onto something.
You would get so much attention. This is not going to cost $377 million.
It won't cost that much.
But it was recognized who's providing the care. It's family, friends, and neighbors, not just family. It'll broaden who's getting the help. It'll recognize that we have a multi-ethnic state we have to really pay attention to if we really want to care for all our kids and have a successful start in school and then a successful lifelong success. So I encourage you to think about some of these different models for producing, all tied to expected results. I think we all agree that any funding should be tied to expected results. But try some different models that fit within the different context of Minnesota. Transform the narrowly defined programs we have now to be more holistic and more integrative. And actually serving families more efficiently because you're serving the parent and the child at the same time. And support them in a culturally and geographically appropriate way. So, thank you very much.
Thank you. That was very interesting, Dr. Station. We appreciate the kind of heads up on the work that you've been doing. Representative Peterson?
Oh, and then thank you, Madam Chair. Just one comment. I think more of a comment than a question. But as I talk with the ECFE staff and other teachers in the various programs, it keeps coming up time and time again that transportation is such a huge issue, getting these families to these centers, getting them to places where they can learn about ECFE programs, etc. Somehow, you know, the families or the children, both, I mean, both need transportation. They're just very limited in that, especially the culturally diverse families and those in poverty.
Yeah.
And we never seem to address that in any of these. I haven't heard it mentioned today, and it's always kind of outside the funding system. And so I think it's something that really needs to be addressed. If these families could get to some of these centers and, you know, for ECFE programs, et cetera, either that or we're going to have to do a lot more outreach in a different way and rethink how we reach the families, because it continues to come up continually.
Yeah. I think one of the ideas to think about those community scholarships is that let the communities decide how they can best spend that for ways that it can meet the needs of all the families. So one way could be through using it for transportation that would be needed to bring the families in. I think when we set up whatever opportunities there are, we have to make sure we're not having those barriers in place to take advantage of the opportunities. Transportation is a problem everywhere, not just in greater Minnesota, but it's a problem in Metro too. Internet access is a problem for low-income families. That if we rely on that, it's just not going to be help the ones who need it the most. Language barriers also for the family. So all these issues, if we are creating opportunities, we can't set up the barriers to taking advantage of those things. I think if we have this process whereby the communities, local communities, whatever groups come together in a way that is transparent and authentic and everyone gets a chance, but they, I think, are good to best. They know how to best meet those needs and maybe would spend that money, could spend some of that on transportation. I agree with you.
Representative Bly and then Representative Mariani. Representative Bly.
Thank you, Chair Flawick. And Dr. Chase, I really appreciate your thinking about rural and metro areas differently and intrigued by some of those ideas and the really being open-minded about the various ways that things can be solved there. I want to add one little thing to your looking at communities, and that is, in my experience, many of the low-income and poor families find work in the least family-friendly situations, which adds to their stress and to their inability to provide the kind of care that they may want to as well. And I'm wondering if added into your thinking might be ways to help employers recognize the need for being more family-friendly and really helping families that are already highly stressed deal with that stress.
Right. Thank you, Representative Paul. I think communities have thought about that. That's what they're doing in Rochester. So working through employers to get a family-friendly neighbor and family to understand that we need to focus on to help parents of young kids. You have to work through employers. So I think that's part of the public-private partnership that has to be part of this, as employers have to also be part of this, because I totally agree.
Representative Mariani.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Dr. Chase, excuse me, for your presentation. I'm intrigued with this $264 gap that exists once you, you know, separate out the cost of delivering and then, you know, do the offset with, you know, what it saves. And you know, obviously you say the bigger payoff shows up outside the K-12 system.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, thinking about Wilder, you know, I think of our Achievement Plus schools and our K-12 communities, which I think is guided by this understanding of a holistic cost-benefit analysis and therefore, you know, holistic interactions. So I'm also thinking about the Harlem Enterprise Zone, or Children's Zone, rather, Harlem Children's Zone, Jeffrey Canada's work in New York, which, as I understand it, you know, further continues to, you know, blur and blend a early learning, or not early, K-12 learning experience that involves all these other you know, parts of our society that arguably will have cost benefit if we get it right for K-12. And so, you know, just in terms of pushing kind of the, you know, the creative juices here, what about you know, exploring how our current outlays for health and mental health and housing, for instance, in Minnesota, can be part of closing that $264 million a year gap? Because arguably, I think you can do the same kind of study in those sectors, and I suspect that there are, if you get it right for early childhood for the sake of K-12 readiness, my guess is you're also getting it right for some other positive outcomes in terms of mental health issues, etc. Any thoughts about that?
Dr. Case, you probably about a minute to go.
Couple of things. One, you know, the biggest beneficiary, or the biggest reduction, is in actually crime victimization. Not even prisons, but crime victimization of what costs it. So that makes us think about this as we're all in this together. It's a public sort of a public thing. So it's public for public good, public benefit, if you can think about it that way. I think that we've become more too narrow in how we're approaching things, and the more narrow we get, the less likely we're going to succeed. We have to, I think, broaden it, which by thinking that it's a public benefit, and it's broader than that. The other thing we're doing in Minnesota, and I don't know if you've had presentations on this, is thinking about how early learning is connected with all the other systems of family support, health and mental health, early intervention, special needs. It takes all of that to make sure we have families who are supported, where kids that are thriving and ready for life and successful. So all those interconnections are things we have to think about so that all kids have a fair start and all the opportunities.
Madam Chair, I'm intrigued by the notion of, you know, say for every dollar we pump into incarceration, we set aside 10 cents for early childhood. I mean, that kind of thing. I know it's kind of crazy, you know, sounds kind of crazy, but, you know, if the cost-benefit analysis is there, why not?
It would make a lot of sense. Yeah, I think that this is probably one of the more creative things I've seen in a long time, and I suspect you leaked it so you could get some bills going over here at the legislature.
Oh, the ECFFM?
Yeah. But we'll see. We may want to take a look at some. If anybody's interested in that, that'd be an interesting concept to reshuffle the money. Not sure everybody in the audience would like
that. I also coined the term FFNRS, so if you heard that.
Family, friend, and neighbor RS? Is that a new store coming? Yeah.
No, well, we are all FFN, if you think about it.
Well, thank you for being here, and thank you, members. And we hope to see you tomorrow at the summit, everybody, and then Thursday for our hearing with Louise Stoney. That this meeting is adjourned.